All right, let's go ahead and get started. All right, good afternoon. Just a quick housekeeping note. This session is being recorded, so if you wouldn't mind, just silence your cell phones or other mobile devices as well. You will also be able to download the slides along with the recording as well. And I'm actually excited to tell you that in this particular deck, there are a lot more slides in a hidden appendix than we have time to go through. So many of those slides talk about things like namespaces and certificate planning, and they show you all the different names that you would need if you're using a bound or unbound namespace and so forth. So you're definitely going to want to download this deck after the event. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a senior program manager on our Office 365 Customer Experience, or CXP, team. Among other things, I'm on the market development team, so we're responsible for removing barriers to deployment of Office 365 around the areas of risk, compliance, trust, privacy, and others. So if you have any questions in those areas, I'm happy to take them as well. If you also want to know, I've got my email address up there as well, so if you have any questions after the show, please do feel free to ask, and I'll do my best to get answers for you. So in this session, Deploying Exchange Server 2016 Preview, we're going to talk about preparing for 2016, coexistence and migration, and then we'll actually walk through what it's like to do the deployment. Now, let's see who's in the room. How many of you are running 2007? All right, 2010? 2013. Has anybody deployed the preview of 16 in a lab? Okay, two, three people. All right, great. So, quick disclaimer. I'm talking about a preview product, a product we have not yet released. The engineering train is still rolling along. I think you could see it here in a second. Did it already go by? Did I miss the train? I'm going back. I want to see the train. Okay, look closely. Wait, there it goes. Okay. Phew, the train. It's still rolling along. Okay, we're still in preview. We haven't shipped this yet, so things could change. Literally everything I'm about to tell you for the next hour could completely change by the time we ship. Okay, it could. It's not going to, but it could. But I have to say that because we haven't shipped yet. Okay, so let's start by talking about preparing for Exchange 2016. And let's just do a brief recap of what's new. I'm not going to drill very deep into these because it's all documented on TechNet, and you can go and read this stuff for yourself. But just hitting the highlights as an example, the client access server role components, or what we would call the client access services, they are now a part of the mailbox server role, leaving the mailbox server role as the only internal role. And in fact, now with 2016, we're just down to two roles at RTM, the mailbox server role internally and an edge transport server role in your perimeter network. Outlook web app has been renamed. It's now called Outlook on the Web. Okay, not a huge change there, but it is a rebranding that's important for our Outlook branding. And there are many, many new features in Outlook for the Web, Outlook on the Web as well. We also now support in Exchange 2016 Outlook's modern authentication, which is based on the Active Directory authentication library as well. So the modern auth that Outlook took the steps ahead to do in 2013 SP1 and 2016, we are now supporting in Exchange 2016. MAPI over HTTP is now our default protocol. That is supported along with RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere, but our preferred protocol and our long-term future protocol is MAPI over HTTP. And we've got some new integration with both OneDrive for OneDrive up in the cloud and an Office web app server on premises for rendering Word, PowerPoint, Excel, and OneNote files within the Outlook on the Web experience. The hybrid configuration wizard has now also changed. It's not a tool that will ship. It's a small cloud-based app that when you run it, will download to your workstation and invoke and become the new wizard that you run. We did that intentionally so that we no longer need to wait for updates to be shipped to Exchange in order for us to ship updates to HCW. This allows us to be very, very fast in our updates and pick up any corner cases right away without having to wait for the next cumulative update cycle. We've also added additional sensitive information types into DLP. A sensitive information type is something like a driver's license number, credit card number, passport number, those kinds of things. We now have, in Exchange 2016, more than 80 predefined sensitive information types that you can use with DLP or with e-discovery searches or searching across SharePoint, OneDrive, or Exchange 2016 as well. And DLP is based on transport rules, and transport rules have also been enhanced, including with new actions and conditions as well. In fact, one of the new actions you could do now is have this instant reporting notification go to multiple distribution lists. In 2013, if you wanted to send incident reports from transport activity, we only let you send it to one DL. Now we can send it to multiple ones. Another big one, public folder support for in-place e-discovery and in-place hold. We made a major architectural change with public folders when we moved to 2013. We got rid of the public folder databases, and basically public folders now became mailboxes on a mailbox database. But in 2013, even though they were kind of like user mailboxes, we still didn't support things like e-discovery or in-place hold. We do now in 2016. And we've also added an enhanced compliance search that can be done through PowerShell as well. So if you do need to do compliance-related searching across your mailbox data, we now have a whole new set of commandlets for you to do that with. All right, what's gone? Well, gone is the client access server role. And I say gone, all the functionality is still there. It's just in the mailbox role. It's just not a separate server role anymore that you can deploy. We just allow you to deploy the mailbox role, and when you deploy mailbox, you get CAS, hub, UM, and mailbox all on the one box. Support for MAPI CDO connectivity is gone. We're actually blocking that. So if you've got any apps that are using that, they won't be able to connect to the Exchange server. You'll either have to convert to Exchange Web Services, or better yet, move to the new REST APIs that we've introduced in 2016 that we've already had out in Office 365 for a while. And support for older versions of Outlook, including Outlook 2007 and Outlook for Mac 2008, the Web Services edition. Both of those are no longer supported as well. Things that are de-emphasized, and by de-emphasized, I want to stress that we're using a very particular term here. Typically, when we talk about features that are going away or gone, we'll use one of three terms. We'll either say de-emphasized, deprecated, or cut. Okay, cut's pretty easy to understand. The feature's just gone. It doesn't exist anymore. MAPI CDO connectivity was cut. It's gone. Client access server role was cut. It's gone. It doesn't exist. Deprecated means something's in this version, but it's not going to be in the next version. And so the third term is de-emphasized. De-emphasized is things that are in this version, we don't know if they're going to be in the next version. We don't think they are, but we're not deprecating them. We just don't know yet, but no one's really using them, and eventually we'd just like them to go away. Things like the third-party replication APIs. There hasn't been a single customer that I know of that have used those since we introduced them back in Exchange 2010. Not a single customer, so we're dropping those. RPC over HTTP, that is being de-emphasized in favor of MAPI over HTTP, a much more modern protocol, the stack of which is wholly owned by the Exchange team versus RPC over HTTP, which is a shared stack between Windows and Exchange. And then support for cluster administrative access points, or what you might know as the cluster network name and cluster IP address in your DAG, those things are going away as well, or being de-emphasized. Still available in this version, but eventually they're going away, maybe the next version, maybe not. Okay, so to reflect some of those changes, here's one of the changes we've made into setup. You can see there is no checkbox for the client access server role. You either install Mailbox or Edge, and you either let it install the Windows Server bits or you don't, okay? And typically we would recommend that you do install the Windows Server stuff this way as well, because Exchange knows exactly what to do. But setup has been fully modified to account for these changes, and so there's no client access role that you can install or remove. Now, the requirements. We do support coexistence with earlier versions of Exchange, but only 2010 and 2013. So if you have 2007 in your environment, you have to get rid of all of them before you'll be able to introduce 2016. Okay? And you'll have to make sure that your 2010 and your 2013 servers are all brought up to the minimum requirements. The preview bits have a slightly different requirements than what we think the final RTM requirements will be, but the asterisk up there means it's subject to change. In other words, we reserve the right to release at RTM of 2016 a CU for 2013 and maybe an RU for 2010 for coexistence purposes. We don't think we're going to need that now. We think the ones that are out there will work with RTM, but that's subject to change. We do require that you have Windows Server 2008 or later, forced functional mode, and global catalog servers. I would hope that most of you have started to move beyond that or maybe have moved beyond that, but at a minimum, we need 2008 forced functional mode and GCs. And then the clients can be running 2010 SP2, 2013 SP1, Outlook 2016 as well, or Outlook for the Mac 2011 or later. We do support only full GUI installs, okay? So we can't do what we used to call the server core install or the no GUI install. We need the full GUI in order to install Exchange. And this can go on 2012, 2012 R2, or Windows Server 2016 once it's released. For those of you who may have heard earlier, maybe you saw the Ignite North America presentation, or maybe you read some earlier info about 2016, we added Windows Server 2012 later in the game. We weren't originally going to support that. We only wanted to do R2 and 2016, but we have since changed our mind, and we've added Windows Server 2012 as supported OS. We do need .NET Framework 4.5.2. That's the only thing that we validated right now. 4.6 has not been validated with any version of Exchange, so you don't want that on any of your Exchange servers, not just 2016. And we do expect to still need the same versions of the Windows Management Framework and the Unified Communications Managed API as well. Those are subject to change, but I don't think those are going to change. And I mentioned the Office Web App server that does need to go on a separate hardware that cannot be co-located with an Exchange server role. For Outlook on the web, that supports Microsoft Edge, IE 11, and the latest version of Insert Popular Browser here. All right. Now, all existing Exchange servers I mentioned have to be brought up to a minimum prerequisite level, and that includes your Edge transport servers, because once you create an Edge subscription, the Edge transport version information is known in your internal Active Directory, and that's what Exchange 2016 setup will look at, your internal AD, to figure out what version of servers that you have. So even if you have updated, say for instance, Edge 01 to the latest version, if you don't redo the Edge subscription, internally it will not reflect that it's been updated. So you have to redo the Edge subscription, update internal Active Directory, because that's all that setup sees. Setup will not go and talk to each server. All it's doing is looking at version information in AD. So after you do your prerequisites on your existing legacy servers, if one of them is Edge or multiples are Edge, you need to rerun Edge subscriptions so that AD can be updated. If you don't do that, Exchange setup simply won't work for you. Also, before running Prepare AD, you want to make sure that you do not need to introduce any versions of Exchange that you have previously not introduced. So, those of you on 2010 right now, if you do 2016 Prepare AD in a 2010 org, you will not be able to install Exchange 2013, ever. If you need to preserve that ability, before you run Prepare AD in 2016, you have to install all four internal server roles of 2013 on at least one server in the organization in order to get everything you need in AD to move forward and preserve your ability to reintroduce that version. So what some customers will do is they'll just spin up a VM that has all those four roles on it, and then they'll just leave it somewhere, maybe even shut it off, just to preserve their ability to reintroduce an older version that they hadn't introduced before. So if you're coming from 2013 and you introduce 2016 Prepare AD, it's no big deal. You've already got 2013 in the mix. It's largely if you're going from 2010, skipping 2013, but you want to preserve your ability to do 2013. Keep that in mind. If you don't introduce all of the server roles, running Prepare AD in 2013 is not enough. You have to introduce all the server roles. And if you don't do that, and you were in Prepare AD for 2016, you won't be able to introduce 2013 at all, and there's really nothing we can do to get you out of it, because at that point, AD has been modified beyond our ability to demodify it, if you will. All right. So, a couple other things to look out for. Exchange 2016, like just about every other new version of Exchange, is going to create a new default OAB. And of course, that's going to be largely the same OAB as what you have today, especially if you're using 2013. But Outlook clients don't care about that. They see new OAB and they run and grab it and start downloading it all. So you want to avoid that. Okay, so what you typically want to do is take your existing OAB server and hard code that on all of your mailbox databases to point to that OAB server. So when you introduce the first 16 server and it brings up the new OAB, nothing's going to look to it because they're all hard coded to look at your existing one. And that could save you a potentially large storm of download activity. To give you an example, on disk, I think the Microsoft OAB is like 635 megs. So imagine what would happen if like 10,000 or 20,000 or 80,000 of us started downloading that first thing in the morning because someone stood up a new server. So you want to avoid that stuff. So hard code it on the databases before you install 2016, and you'll completely avoid that problem. All right. Some other things about coexistence and migration. Let's talk about 2010 first. So the 2010 coexistence and migration story is exactly the same as what we had with 2010 and 2013. So if you've gone through that process before, then you've already done it and you already know what to expect. There's no legacy namespace that's required, and Exchange 2016 will simply proxy to 2010. Now, 2010 can't proxy to 2016, so introducing 2016 means it will become the front door for everything. But it's just like if you were introducing 2013. It'll be that easy. So the connectivity depends on the protocol that you're using. Obviously, MAPI over HTTP, that doesn't apply here because that's not available for 2010 mailboxes. But for Outlook on the web or the Exchange Control Panel, now Exchange Administrative Center, the mailbox, the proxy will depend on where the mailbox is. So if the mailbox is in the local site, we'll proxy to the mailbox server in the local site. If it's in a remote site, we'll proxy to that one. If the remote site has an external facing URL, we'll redirect to that site and get the user that way. And ActiveSync, Outlook Anywhere, and all the rest of them, they will simply proxy the request to a 2010 CAS endpoint, and then the 2010 CAS will talk RPC to the local mailbox stack on that server. These are the condensed steps to upgrade from 2010 to 2016. I'm not going to go through them deeply, but I want to walk you through what you need to do. You're obviously going to prep the environment. That can mean service packs or roll-up updates on your 2010 servers. Might also mean recreating that Edge subscription that I mentioned earlier. You're going to install Exchange 2016, preferably using a deployment site, and I'll talk about what those are in a bit. You'll configure the Exchange 2016 URLs. For your mail and auto discover endpoints. You can then move your load balance namespace from 2010 to 2016 when you're ready to accept clients. You'll set up your DAGs, start moving your mailboxes, which will be online moves so users won't be interrupted. And then you'll repeat that for all of your internet-facing sites first, one at a time, and then you'll repeat that for all your non-internet-facing sites after that, again, one at a time. Then once you're ready, then you can move your MX records, usually about 50% halfway through the migration is when most customers decide to swing transport over from 2010 to 2016. But really, it's whatever makes sense for you. If you want to do that sooner or later, maybe you want to take advantage of some of the new transport rules or DLP features in 2016, you might want to move transport over to 2016 sooner rather than later. When you're in a coexistence state, this is typically what it will look like. Again, it's either going to proxy from 2016 to 2010, or if we have an external facing site with an external URL populated, then it's going to be a redirect to the remote site based on where the mailbox lives. Now, if you're coming from 2013 to 2016, it is even easier than that. Again, you don't need any form of legacy namespaces. And not only can Exchange 2016 proxy to 2013, but 2013 can proxy to 2016 as well. And in fact, they'll share the same namespace. And they're almost, from this standpoint, largely interchangeable. So the user can talk to either, and either will happily proxy them to wherever their mailbox database is located, whether it's on 2016 or 2013. So what that means is now you've got two choices. 2010 only had the one choice. 2010 mailbox user accessing a 16 namespace, but now we can have a 16 mailbox user accessing a 2013 namespace or a 2013 mailbox user accessing a 2016 namespace. And again, in either case, it's still going to be a proxy to whichever mailbox server is hosting the active copy of the user's database. Okay, so it's a very simple and straightforward and very smooth migration. There are a couple differences around OAB in terms of where they'll proxy to, because they'll also make a shadow copy of that OAB. But by and large, it's exactly the same. If 2013 we're simply proxying to another 2013 server, or 2016 we're proxying to a 2016 server. Now, you've got two different options when you're migrating from 2013 to 2016. You can do what we call up proxy or down proxy. So the first option is up proxy, and this is where you're still using 2013 as the front door, and it's simply up proxying to 2016 for users whose mailboxes have already been moved. So all the steps are largely the same as 2010 until you get to step number 9, which is why it's in yellow. This is when, at the end, you would decide to swing the load balance traffic over away from 2013 and over to 2016. And you can do it gradually, which is what we would recommend, or you can do a cutover, which is turn off the 2013 servers, turn on the 2016 servers, and be done with it. That is also supported as well. So this is option 1. Doing the up proxy. Option 2 has the same steps, except that last step is in a slightly different order. So we're going to down proxy, which means halfway through around step 5, before we create the DAGs, we're going to go ahead and switch the namespace, so we're coming in through 2016 instead. And so this will then be down proxying all the requests to 2013. Otherwise, all the steps are identical. It's really up to you as to when you switch the namespace. You get the choice there. So this is what the CAS replacement process would look like if you're up proxying. One thing I'm not showing in these slides are the traffic that is internal within a 2016 server. So I'm not showing any of the traffic between CAS and mailbox on 16. So you've got the load balancers sending all the traffic to your 2013 CAS. That's what it is today. You want to introduce 2016. So you introduce that. Again, it's the mailbox role, so it's kind of like a mailbox. And then 2016 client services are added to the load balance pool, so we can start answering client requests as well. And then the 2013 CAS services are removed. And every time you add another 2016 to the load balance pool, you remove a 2013 one after you verify it's working. And it's kind of like this one-for-one replacement that just goes on until all of your 2013 CAS are gone and you're left with just the 2016 ones handling everything. Okay, so that's one way to do it. There's a second way to do it as well. You can use DNS response ratios. Okay, so there is a configuration within DNS where you can define the percentage of requests you want to go to each server. So you could, for example, introduce a server and then configure DNS, in this case, since we've got a total of 4 servers, to send 25% of the requests over to the Exchange 2016 server. Okay? And that means the other 75% requests will go to the VIP that's in front of the 2013 CAS servers. Then you introduce another 2016, and you make that 50% going over here and 50% going over there. Then you introduce another one, and it's 75% and 25%. And you introduce another one, and finally it's 100% and 0%. And eventually your CAS are gone altogether for 2013. Okay, so that is another way to do that as well. And then this is probably the most complex coexistence environment, where you've got 2010, 2013, and 2016 all existing. But again, the behavior is largely going to be the same. Wherever the front door is, that front door is simply going to look up in Active Directory the version of the mailbox that the user's running, find where that mailbox is, and then send that proxied request over to the mailbox server that hosts the active copy. So it could be something that's doing a redirect, it could be something that's doing a proxy, but this is basically the flow if you had everything in the environment, and additional sites as well. Okay, and eventually, you can actually get to the point where you would remove 2013 client access services altogether, and you wouldn't even have them in the mix anymore, and it could look something like this. So you still have the 2013 mailbox role, and you've got 2016 here and 2010 here, but no 2013 CAS services because 2016 is handling all the client access service requests and directing them to either mailbox server as appropriate. Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about installing Exchange 2016. Okay, so this is the recommended and also the easiest way to do the install. And so you'd start by installing the new server into what we call a deployment site. And I'll get into a deployment site in a bit. Then you install the prerequisites. It says prerequisites. I should fix that. It's supposed to be prerequisites. And then you reboot. And then install Exchange 2016, allowing it to install the Windows prerequisites for itself as well. Because again, it knows exactly what it's need. Then you can configure the server, change its IP address to move it from the deployment site to a production site, and then you could add the server to the load balancing pool. It's really, really that simple. So let's talk about using a deployment site. Why a deployment site? What happens as soon as a new Exchange server is installed and turned on and stood up? Yes? Maybe. No, it's not about transport. That's right, the clients. Okay, so the first thing is it becomes a valid endpoint for service connection requests, especially for auto-discover, okay? And of course, it hasn't been configured yet. It has the wrong information. That's not gonna match what Outlook is looking for, so users get this nasty certificate pop-up saying Outlook has a mismatch, are you sure you wanna connect? That could be scary. The other thing that happens, it also, because it's a valid endpoint, it also becomes a valid source for all things auto-discover as well. So now it can give out information, including the wrong information. Here's the interesting thing about auto-discover. There's no guarantee that the server that's answering the request is going to give you the right information. It might not give you information from its own. Auto-discover itself will only look largely to the first one that was registered. Okay, so if it's the first one, it might not have the right information in there. But it is a valid source of information, so that information could be passed to a client, which again is in turn going to cause one of those certificate pop-up errors and scare the user a little bit. So, how do we prevent that from happening? We create what we call a deployment site. Now, this isn't doing anything other than leveraging the fact that Active Directory simply allows for sites to have overlapping subnets. Okay, so by that, I could have a subnet assigned to one site and then take part of that subnet or even just a single IP from that subnet and assign it to another site. And Active Directory will fully respect that and operate that way. So here what I have is I've got this /24 subnet, and that's NAM East, that is my production site. But out of that /24 subnet, I can actually just carve out a /29 subnet, and that basically gives me 6 IP addresses in that subnet that I can then assign to my other site, my deployment site called NAM Deploy. Okay? And again, Active Directory will recognize this. It'll see that the entire subnet is part of the production one, but there are 6 IPs now that have been carved up from a deployment site, so anything that is assigned one of those IPs now is considered to be in that deployment site. So one of those IPs will be needed for a GC in that site, but the other 5 could be for anything, so they could be for Exchange servers that I'm building. And it doesn't have to be /29. You could go in and individually create a site and just manually add 1 or 2 IP addresses for the servers that you're installing at that time if you wanted to do it this way. I think using this is a little bit easier because it just gives you that reservation of the other 5 addresses, but it's up to you. So when you have a deployment site, you want to make sure that it's all set up properly before you proceed with setup because, again, the whole point is keeping this new but unconfigured server out of the production site so it doesn't interfere with clients. So using NLTest is a great way to verify what site Windows thinks it's in. Then once Exchange is installed, you can use Get Exchange Server, and that will tell you what site Exchange thinks it's in, and hopefully they should match. I've actually seen cases where they don't because the admin did the subnetting wrong in AD. So you want to check that and make sure that that matches as well. And then before you change the server's IP from one of the IPs in the deployment site to an IP on the production site, you'll also want to change the AD site scope to reflect the appropriate site as well. That way, everything will match. Exchange will be basically forklifted out of the deployment site and put into the production site after you change its IP. Okay, so that's just a tip. It's nothing that's required, but using a deployment site does, you know, tend to save you from some headaches that can occur when you're not using one. All right, so MAPI over HTTP, that is part of the preferred architecture, and that may or may not be enabled by default depending on your scenario. So if you're doing a greenfield environment, you don't have Exchange at all, and you introduce Exchange 2016, we will enable MAPI over HTTP by default as the protocol for your clients, for your Outlook clients. If you are deploying Exchange 16 in a Exchange 2010 org, we will not automatically enable it by default. You will have to turn it on. If you are deploying 2016 in a 2013 org that does not have it enabled, we won't enable it. But if it does have it enabled, we will enable it for 2016 as well. So the behavior will depend on what it's going into. So we're not just going to surprise you and suddenly turn it on where you might have been in an environment that supported it but had it off, like 2013. But we are reminding admins to enable it. So right at the end of setup, when setup completes, in the middle of setup, when it's doing its prerequisite check, if we detect that you're in an existing 2013 or 2016 environment and it's not enabled, we will tell you that it should be enabled. It's not going to be an error, so it won't stop setup, but it'll be a warning telling you that it really is our preferred protocol and you really should enable it for your servers and your users. So here's some scenarios for you. So you've got an Exchange 2013 org. They don't have MAPI over HTTP enabled, and they want to migrate to Exchange 2016, and they have a goal of only enabling MAPI over HTTP for users as they're migrated to 2016. So they don't want any 2013 mailbox users to use it. They only want 2016 mailbox users to use it. So I'm not going to drill into these steps, but these are these steps that you would actually use in order to achieve this configuration. So we do have ways beyond the on-off switch that we had in 2013 for you to be able to control which users get the new protocol and when they get it as well. So that's one scenario. Another scenario is you have a pure Exchange 2016 org. You don't have any 2013 or 2010 in there. And you want to block Outlook on Windows connectivity for everyone except a few special VIPs. And you want to do it with the fewest steps. We now give you a way to do that as well without having to do actual MAPI client version blocking on the server, which could be a real pain considering the plethora of different MAPI versions that you may be dealing with. So this is the fewest admin steps and the least amount of complexity for you to enable this. All right, public folders, who's using public folders? All right, so a public folder migration from 2010 to 2013, from 2010 to 2016 is exactly like it was from 2010 to 2013. It's a staged cutover migration where you synchronize most of the data, then you lock everything, synchronize the rest of the data, and you unlock what we call modern public folders. And those modern public folders, as I mentioned earlier, are folders that now exist in mailboxes, in mailbox databases. Okay, the same paradigm exists in 2016. We have made improvements to public folders, but it's the same exact architecture. So the steps for moving public folders from 2013 to 2016 are this. Just step one, move it. And you don't have to watch it go. You just click off the move and away it goes. It's really that easy. All right, Kerberos authentication. That's also easy in 2016 as well because we validated in both Office 365 and our dog food environment that both 2013 and 2016 can share the same alternate service account credentials. Okay, so that means in a 2013 and 2016 environment, you only need one ASA shared between the two of them. And you can, in fact, even though that is our guidance for 2013, you can go to that URL and use that same exact guidance to set up Kerberos for Exchange 2016. It's the same exact steps. The only sort of gotcha is if you also have Exchange 2010 in the mix. 2010 cannot share an ASA account with 2013 or 2016. So if you had 2010 in the mix, you'd have two ASAs, not one. But if you just have 2013 and 2016, you'll just have the single shared ASA between the two of them, and that should work great for you. Also, there's some system mailboxes. Now, this may or may not get you, because typically this is only affecting the TAP customers who've deployed in production now. This may not be an issue once we RTM, but if you are deploying the preview bits in a lab, then you will run into this. And it's basically you have to take the system mailboxes from 2013 and move them to an Exchange 2016 mailbox server, or functionality will break. So as an example, this middle one that I've highlighted in yellow there, that innocuous small little system mailbox is actually responsible for every single e-discovery search that can be done. And so because of that, if it's not moved to a 2016 mailbox server, you won't be able to do e-discovery searches in 2016. Okay. Similarly, the one at the bottom, the migration mailbox, same thing as well. You won't be able to do match migrations where 2016 is the target database unless and until the migration mailbox is moved over to the 2016 environment. Again, that may or may not affect you if you're doing preview in the lab today with 2013. It will affect you, but in RTM, we hope that this won't be an issue and you won't have to deal with it. But keep in mind, there may be some mailbox moving that you have to do as well. All right, so Office Web Apps Server and Outlook on the Web. I mentioned this in the last session. So previously, when we introduced this ability to do this inline rendering of Office files inside Outlook Web App, that was back in Exchange 2010, and that was using a third-party add-on called Stellant. And we actually shipped that up into Exchange Online, and we lived with that for about a year and a half. And then we started the process of moving over towards the solution that SharePoint had also created using our own technologies to also do that rendering as well. So we've now simply abandoned the Stellant add-on, and we're now using the SharePoint solution, which is known as the Office Web App Server. So that means on-premises, you deploy this extra server, and this server provides you with the inline rendering of Office files like Word, PowerPoint, Excel, OneNote, and so forth within the Outlook on the Web experience, formerly Outlook Web App. If you don't need that functionality, then these are totally optional servers. But if you do want that functionality, they do need to be deployed. They need to be deployed with dedicated namespaces. And even though I'm only showing an individual server here, they can be deployed in server farms with a load balancer in front of them as well. So if you're in a very large environment, you can do high availability. You can do site resilience by putting them in multiple data centers and so forth. But you will need this server functionality if you want that user experience. And the user experience, here's what it will look like if you don't have that functionality. You'll get, when you click on a Word document, for example, you'll just see only the download option. And if you're on a computer that has Word installed, you'll see this dialog that gives you the open option. But if you're on, like, maybe a public kiosk or some internet cafe machine or just any computer that doesn't have the app installed, then you just get the save dialog as well. Once you configure it, and you'll configure it by basically entering in the URL for the Office Web App Server for the WAC discovery endpoint property of the mailbox server. And this is a relatively recent change. Previously, when we started down this path, we had an org-wide WAC discovery endpoint, so all servers would point to the same one. And we've since moved away from that, where now we're pointing to individual ones so that we're always pointing to one in our local site. And once that endpoint is filled in and configured, you restart the MS Exchange OAuth app pool, and then that will give you a new experience that includes a view option. And if you use the view option, then you'll get this side-by-side view of the document, complete with a flaming unicorn and Ninja Cat, who hopefully you all found out this week is a girl. Okay, good. You should know that because of the ribbon. All right. So this is the experience that you get here if you have the Office Web App Server. If you don't have the Office Web App Server, it's just a download experience, and then it depends on whether or not you have the app installed in order to do the editing. All right. The connectivity flow, just walking through it real quick, you've got Exchange talking to the Office Web App Server. And it's going to be based on the user activity. Exchange will first use a Discover URL once it's configured to figure out the file types that are available so it knows what types of files to send to the OWASP server for rendering. And then the OWASP will return the list of files to it in a table format. And then when the user opens up a mail that has an attachment that matches that, that's when they would get the option for view or download. And if they chose view, then Exchange is going to build a URL complete with an OAuth token that contains the user's credentials. That token will get sent to the OWASP server, which will look up the user's credentials and, assuming they have rights to do that, build the rendering in an iframe next to them, and then render the retrieve the document and render it fully within the Office Web Apps client, like Word Web App, PowerPoint Web App, and so forth. Okay, so there is a lot of robust and rich communication that is happening between the client side and the Exchange server and this Office Web App server. And this is why they need good LAN connectivity. They have to be in the same data center and working, you know, very tightly integrated with one another. Yes?
If you've got an email that goes to multiple people with an attachment, it's going to do it for each individual user who opens the...
So the question is, if the attachment's sent to multiple people, will it render it for each user as they click view? The answer is yes. Yes. All right. All right, and the last thing I just want to mention briefly is object management. You can go up or down with object management. 2013 can actually manage 2016 objects. 2016 can imagine 2013 objects. The only thing that you can't do is really manage 2010 objects with either of them simply because of the architectural changes that we made. There have been commandlet name changes, there have been property changes, there have been parameter changes. So if you do have 2010 in the environment, it really would be best to stick with 2010. Either EMC or PowerShell for 2010 management, and then simply use the Exchange Admin Center or a later version of the PowerShell management tools to manage 2013 or 2016. All right. So you've seen how deployments have been simplified, especially now that 2013 can up proxy to 2016, and you don't need to forklift that infrastructure into a new front door if you don't want to. And the Office Web App Server is now the server that you'll use if you want the integrated inline editing and viewing capabilities within Outlook on the web, formerly Outlook Web App. All right. So one more Exchange session tomorrow. It's the high availability and site resilience session. I think that's it for the Exchange track. And then, of course, there's resources. And don't forget to fill out your evals. So with that, we do have a few minutes left. And I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. Yes, sir. Is single instance storage back? No, single instance storage was mostly broken in Exchange 2007 and completely gone in 2010 and forward. And it's not something that we have any plans on ever bringing back. You have to remember, single instance storage was born in the days where we were very constrained on disk space, and we had to make that trade-off between performance and disk space. We don't have to make that trade-off anymore because space really isn't a concern. So we have completely optimized both the store and the extensible storage engine for performance, and we no longer optimize for space. So no more single instance storage. Yes?
If you're using 2013 to manage a 2016 server, the new eDiscovery and whatever other features there, are they useful?
So, great question. If you're using 2013 to manage the 2016 server, are the other features there? No, they wouldn't be. If you're on a 2013 box and you're hitting a 2013 ECP virtual directory, you're getting the 2013 experience. So, if you want the full 2016 experience, you'd have to hit a 2016 server. Yes?
Closely aligned to the Office 365 experience now?
So the question is the enhancements and improvements in DLP more closely aligned to the Office 365 experience? So historically and concurrently, so this hasn't changed, there's only been one primary difference between what we're doing in the cloud and what we're doing on premises. Do you know what that is? I'm not going to put you on the spot. It's reporting. Okay. In the cloud, we include all of these rich reports for you. On premises, we don't. We either make you roll your own by ingesting the Excel file or by using a third-party product, and there are actually several that have jumped into that space and started creating rich reports. My personal opinion is that third-party products are probably overkill for most, since all the data is there anyway, and it's just PowerShell to get it out. So. I would rather invest the time and money in that than a third-party app to do it as well. But other than that, it's the same actions, the same predicates, the same exceptions, the same auditing, same severity, same code. Everything is exactly the same. The one change you'll see happening in the cloud, that will happen in the cloud because we know all the workloads are there, that we're still working on for on-premises is the integration across the whole stack. So for instance, doing DLP sensitive information type searching across Exchange and SharePoint. Okay, so we can build that code for that to work in the cloud because we know largely every Exchange Online user has SharePoint there versus on-premise, we don't necessarily know if they have that, so it's kind of hard to package that up and ship it. But in those cases, if they do have those extra workloads, then that functionality can just light up for them when they're there. And we will try to maintain parity. But it will be largely a cloud-first deployment still. So even as we're planning DLP futures, not just in the server side, but you may have also seen some of the work we're doing within the Office apps themselves. So for instance, DLP within Excel, just like you see the mail tips in Outlook, you'll see mail tips in Excel telling you about those, or mail tips in Word telling you about sensitive types there. Those things will get built and shipped to the cloud first because we can refine them a lot faster and validate them faster, and then they'll make their way in a CU to 16. Right. Yes? Great question. So what do you get in terms of interop between Exchange 2016 and, say, Link or Skype for Business 2013? So that integration, you'll still see the presence information. Will not see all of the features that you had in the previous version. So, for instance, there won't be any support for video. There won't be any support for file transport. It'll basically just be presence and IM in that case. And whether or not there will be specific requirements on the Link / Skype side, those are still TBD at this point until we RTM. But we do anticipate RTMing right around the same time as the other 2016 workloads. So before that happens, we'll have that story figured out. So once we do RTM, you'll know exactly the requirements that you'll need there. All right, yes, sir?
Is it possible to create an availability group between 2016 and previous
version? Great question. And can you create a DAG that has 2013 and 2016 mailbox servers in it? No, you cannot. No, you cannot. No. You have to create a new DAG and move your mailboxes. Yes, sir? Yeah, that was asked earlier. Everything's pre-release, so we don't have any licensing or pricing or packaging information. So we still have no licensing, packaging, or pricing information. So can't comment on any of that. All right. Well, with that, thank you very much for coming. And again, if you have any questions after the event, schnall@microsoft.com. Thanks very much.